journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, January 5th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Deadly spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. We'll spend the hour with Wendell Potter.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the bellow meadows out, but I can't help myself. Why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Today is the first day of work for the 112th Congress, and the new majority already has big plans for the next week. On Monday, House Republicans announced their intention to vote to repeal the historic health care reform legislation, which passed less than a year ago. The vote is scheduled for January 12th. While Republicans are confident repeal will easily pass in the House, they do not have enough votes in the Senate, and certainly the president will not sign a repeal bill. While the debate around the health care bill presents the issue as a battle between socialism and capitalism, in reality, the legislation benefits for-profit insurance companies while putting in place some consumer protections. The health insurance industry, in fact, helped craft the bill using a combination of slick PR moves outwardly supporting reform and behind-the-scenes front groups that viciously attacked real reform through a sophisticated disinformation campaign. We know that this is the two-pronged strategy employed by insurance companies because one of their own PR people quit in disgust and spilled the beans. His name is Wendell Potter, and he worked as a top PR executive for Cigna for years before resigning and speaking out. Potter tells his story in his new book, Deadly Spin, An Insurance Company Insider Speaks Out on How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. We spend the hour today with Wendell Potter. Here's part one of my interview. Welcome to Uprising, Wendell Potter.
Thank you so much.
Now, let's first talk about what's in the news before we get into your book. Do you think that the striking down of the individual mandate, whether it sticks or not, is a good thing?
You know, I just don't know. I'm not at the point of saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that what was encouraging was that he didn't strike any other parts of the legislation. He said that it can go forward. And you're right. He didn't have an injunction against the implementation of the legislation. It will be an appeal. There's no doubt about it. And undoubtedly will be something that goes to the Supreme Court. But I tend to agree with Jamie Cord, it's Consumer Watchdog, that this is a very unpopular aspect of healthcare reform. And President Obama, when he was a candidate, said that he did not support an individual mandate. He did support the public option that was ultimately stripped out of the bill, which is what the insurance industry wanted. But the industry was able to persuade him and Democratic leaders in the House and Senate that the individual mandate should be a part of their bill. So I'm at this point a little bit ambivalent about it. I think it could work, but I was never supportive of the notion that we should be forced to buy insurance if we do not have the option of buying something that is a government-run plan.
And of course, for those people who can't afford it, the government steps in, provides taxpayer subsidies, which is essentially a giveaway to the insurance companies.
It is. And I said when I was testifying before the House and the Senate last year that if Congress passed a bill that included the individual mandate but did not include the public option, they might as well call their bill the Health Insurance Industry Profit Protection and Enhancement Act. And that's what they passed. Now, it does do a lot of good, as you noted. There are a lot of elements in this legislation that does make some of the practices of the insurance industry illegal that should have been outlawed a long time ago. And it has some consumer protections and some things that are good for us, but it also is a bonanza, as you noted, for the insurance industry.
And you have a whole chapter on how the healthcare reform battle played out, as well as how the one before it with the Clintons played out. But I want to start at the beginning with your book. One of the first things you talk about in your book is the insurance industry's campaign against the movie Sicko by Michael Moore, which you were very much involved in. And that story was covered extensively in the press recently, particularly on Democracy Now. But I want to ask you, how did watching the film Sicko affect you personally? What was in the film itself and how it critiqued the insurance companies, because that film wasn't about people who didn't have insurance. It was about people who had insurance.
That's right. And I knew it was true as I was watching it because I handled so many cases. We call them high-profile cases during my career in the industry in which people had been denied coverage for a treatment or procedure that the doctors recommended. So it resonated with me. I knew that he was telling the truth and he had gotten people who had been wronged and had been denied care that they needed. So it had a profound effect on me. I knew that he was telling the truth, and I knew also that the way he characterized the health plans in other countries was also accurate. But the industry didn't want people to think that way. They wanted to try to discredit Michael Moore and the movie, and they spent a lot of premium dollars, your premium dollars and mine, to discredit it.
Another powerful story that pushed you toward the edge of resigning your position at Cigna was the case right here in Southern California of the 17-year-old Natalene Sarkisian, an Armenian-American young woman living in Glendale who died after Cigna refused initially to approve payment for her very badly needed liver transplant. How did that incident affect you personally? And also, what did you learn from the way in which it galvanized people around the country, the activism, particularly by California nurses?
It affected me more than anything else had ever affected me in my career. In fact, it was that case that I was involved in that led me to turn in my resignation, to leave my job. It was just heart-wrenching. I was hopeful that the company would change its mind. As you noted, Cigna refused to provide coverage for a liver transplant that Natalene needed. She was 17 years old. She had leukemia. But regrettably, by the time that Cigna did agree to cover it, it was too late, and she died just shortly after Cigna said it would cover the procedure. I have a daughter myself. I have a daughter who's now 23, but at that time, she was not much older than Natalene, and I could just imagine what the family was going through. It was heart-wrenching, and I know, you know, I felt that, and I could just imagine how devastated the family was.
Now, for those of us on the outside, we always wonder, well, what do the corporate executives feel when they look at the rest of us from inside? Were you the only one who was grieving for Natalene?
There were others that I know that I worked with who were very hopeful that the procedure would be approved for coverage and it could be done in time and that she would live. But what happens is that I'll speak from my own experience, is that when you are in the corporate setting, as you're getting promotions and are paid quite well, you begin to become insulated and isolated. And you begin to think of people in terms of numbers rather than flesh and blood human beings. And that's what helps you to go to work every day. You don't necessarily have to associate your actions with the consequences on real human beings. And I was able to live that way until the Natalene case came along and also a few other things that happened that same year. I could no longer just pretend that I was dealing with numbers all the time.
Now, the Natalene case is sort of classified on the inside as what you refer to a horror story.
Right.
What do insurance companies look at as horror stories, and what do they usually do about them? Are there lessons there for those of us battling with insurance companies?
There's a big lesson, and the lesson is to make yourself known, become a squeaky wheel, because it's true, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, it gets the attention.
Because of the bad PR?
Because of the bad PR. Companies hate bad PR, and they'll take action to try to stop it or to even keep it from happening. There were many times over the course of my career we would get calls from reporters or from producers who would be calling us on behalf or about a Cigna enrollee who was saying that they had been denied care that they needed, and that automatically elevated that case into what we called a high-profile case, also known as a horror story.
And sometimes even the CEO of the company would get involved.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the CEO definitely was involved in the Natalene Sarkisian case. The more serious it got, the greater the threat to the company's reputation, the more people were involved in it. So my advice to anyone, if you've been wronged by your insurance company, pull out all the stops. Try to get the media to pay attention to your case. Call your insurance commissioner at the state level. Call your member of Congress. Call a state legislator. Just raise hell.
Wendell Potter is my guest. He is the author of Deadly Spin, and he was the PR executive, one of the lead PR executives at Cigna Insurance. He's now a senior fellow in healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy, and he joins me in studio. Now, let's talk about one of the very little-known aspects of the stumbling blocks toward real healthcare reform that Natalene's mother, Hilda Sarkisian, is very involved in trying to raise awareness about, and that is this little-known law, I believe it was passed in 1974, called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that is essentially has essentially been turned into a weapon for the insurance companies against being prosecuted, against being charged by individuals who have either died or their families of people who have died. What exactly is this Employee Retirement Income Security Act?
Yeah, and Hilda Sarkisian and her family had never heard of this, and it goes by the acronym of ERISA. And it was passed by Congress in 1974, and it was passed initially to protect people from their employers who were shutting down and essentially stealing their pension money. And so this was passed to protect their retirement earnings or their retirement funds and the pension plans. It's been interpreted by the courts in years after that to apply also to health benefit plans. And what it does, because it's a federal law, it preempts state laws. In other words, if you feel like you've been denied care and you are in one of these ERISA-protected plans, then you have no recourse in the local courts. And it's usually for big employers that provide insurance benefits to their employees. And that was the case with the Sarkisian family. But most of us get our coverage through the workplace, which means that we have very little recourse if we've been wronged, if we've been denied care, as the Sarkisians were. We can get almost no support from the courts.
And one of the only things that they could get support for was if Natalene had lived.
Yes.
Through a federal court, they would have been able to win reimbursement. But because
right.
she died, the family couldn't get anything.
Yes, it is the most insane and insensitive thing. And I think I agree with Hilda Sarkisian, and I've told her that I will work with her to try to raise the awareness of this. People don't understand that. And yes, it was incredible that because she died, they had no recourse whatsoever. If she had lived, you're right, and the courts could have awarded the family and Natalene the value of the procedure that was denied. But because she died, no procedure could be done. And so consequently, the family had nothing at all that they could get from the courts.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of the statewide efforts to pass single-payer health care. One of the, as I mentioned earlier, Vermont is considering it very seriously. They've hired this Harvard economist to design Taiwan's healthcare, single-payer healthcare system. But he himself has said that states would need to get a waiver for ERISA and that no state has been able to do that, including California. So
right.
Does ERISA also stand as a huge stumbling block to single-payer health care in states?
It's a big stumbling block, and states need to understand that, and individual citizens need to become aware of ERISA. And I don't think until now people have just not been paying attention. That's why I devoted an entire chapter in my book to ERISA, so that people can become aware of just how protective it is of insurance companies and big employers. It lets them get away literally with murder. And Congress needs to change this. There have been some attempts in the past, but because of the power and influence of the insurance industry and big corporations, Congress has never really tampered with it.
Mm. Wendell, you write almost as much about the PR propaganda and spin as you do about the healthcare issues in your book. How do insurance companies protect things like ERISA? What are some of the methods they use?
Well, they use a number of PR techniques. One is called reframing the debate. And with ERISA, for example, their tact is to say, well, that if you overturn ERISA, then that'll open the floodgates for litigation and your premium dollars will go up and people will lose their jobs. They're making stuff up, but they're doing this to scare people. It's part of what's called a fear-mongering campaign. And we saw their fear-mongering campaign, or at least I did, and I think we all can probably recognize the results of it, to scare people away from reform. they used a term called government takeover of the healthcare system, for example. And that was a term that was carefully worded with the intention of scaring people into thinking that this legislation would result in the government taking over the entire healthcare system. This legislation does nothing of the kind, not even close to it. But they want you to believe that. So they can get – they hire big PR firms. They spend a lot of money – again, your dollars and mine that come from premiums – to finance these PR and lobbying campaigns. And usually the core component is a disinformation campaign, often just outright lies.
One of the interesting things is the way in which medical doctors are hired by the insurance companies to sign off on decisions about what to cover and what not to cover. For example, in the case of Natalie and Sarkeesian, there was a medical director at Cigna who was able to say, no, this is an experimental procedure. Aren't these doctors being extremely unethical?
You know, what I want to – what I describe in this book in that case, I want people to understand that, yes, they are doctors. They have a medical degree, but they are just every bit as much of a corporate employee of a corporation as I was. And they know that they have a role to play, just as I did, to help their company meet Wall Street's expectations. And we really are here talking about what Wall Street wants and what Wall Street demands that these companies do. So this medical director and all medical directors who work for for-profit insurance companies know that they have to be mindful of what their CEOs want to happen within the company to make sure that Wall Street is happy. So you don't need to get a memo from the CEO every week saying you have to deny certain number of procedures. It's more nuanced. It's more subtle, but it's part of the corporate culture. You know that you have to do something. So in this case, for example, Natalie's doctors sent a request. They had to get prior approval, as they call it, from because it was a big important procedure from Cigna. And this medical director, 2,000 miles away in Pittsburgh, who had never seen Natalie, who had never examined her, just looked at the documentation that her doctor sent him, said in his opinion he didn't think it was medically necessary. So the point that I make here is that people need to realize that during the debate we were the opponents of reform tried to scare us into thinking that if reform passed, especially if we got single payer, that we would have a government bureaucrat between us and our doctors. The reality is that we have a corporate bureaucrat, someone who is accountable only to Wall Street, standing between us and our doctors.
And when you hear an insurance company saying that a certain procedure is experimental, you know, I'm just sort of wondering how that plays out. You have parents who have a child who has a small chance of living because they might be able to be saved through a particular procedure, but the insurance company makes a calculation and says, our calculations show that even if the procedure happens, your child is likely to not survive. And so they deny coverage,
right,
which in any kind of a just world would be unconscionable, right? Because they're literally making a calculation about a person's life. Even a 10% chance of survival,
right,
for a parent is more than worth it.
It's absolutely right. And I don't think people really understand how it goes on. Certainly our resources are not unlimited. We can't pay for everything that everybody thinks that they should get. We just don't have unlimited resources. But in this case, these are arbitrary decisions. It could have been that a medical director, if she had been in an Aetna plan or a Blue Cross plan, she might have gotten that procedure without any questions asked. If she had been in Canada or the United Kingdom, it might have been a very different situation. We'll never know because the circumstances were what they were. And she did not live as a result of the denial. I could just empathize with the family as they were going through this, and they knew that their benefit plan covered transplants, so they were optimistic when their doctor said and there was a liver waiting for Natalie.
Right, a perfect match.
But a doctor 2,000 miles away who worked for a big corporation that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange said no.
One of the other things that you talk about deeply affecting you in your book is the remote area medicals set up in Virginia that you went to, where basically this one nonprofit organization sets up this huge outdoor treatment camp, if you will, where people get free healthcare. There was one in Los Angeles, I think the first time they did it in an urban setting a couple of years ago. And they're inundated with people, Americans, desperate desperately seeking health care and treatments that is so reminiscent of the kind of scenes we see in refugee camps and third world countries. How did witnessing what happened there in Virginia also move you closer and closer toward resigning?
It moved me significantly closer. And I think you would say that the Nadalene Sarkeesian case might have been what made me ultimately decide to leave my job. But this was one of the things that's kind of the middle of my journey. I'm from East Tennessee, which is a mountainous part of the state, and it's quite rural, and a lot of the counties and towns are remote. I picked up a newspaper when I was visiting my parents, and this was in July of 2007, and I read about a healthcare expedition, as it was being called, that was held at a fairgrounds a few miles north of where my parents and I grew up. And I went there out of curiosity, and when I went there and walked through the county fairground gates in Wise County, Virginia, I saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who were standing in a more than one long line. In the rain, they were soaking wet, waiting to get care that was being provided to them free by doctors and nurses who were volunteering their time. And in many cases, the care was being given in barns and animal stalls. And when I saw that, it just hit me immediately that what I was doing for a living was making it necessary for these people to have to resort to that to get care in such an inhumane way.
Mm. Wendell Potter, let's talk about the history of public relations, which you also go into in your book. You were essentially a student of public relations. You became a PR expert and worked your way up into Cigna. The history of PR in this country is a very sordid one. Mm-hmm. That relates to all sorts of things, including the tobacco industry justifying its behavior. How evil is the kind of propaganda that we see coming out of insurance companies? I mean, these are life or death situations.
They really are, and there is significant evil. You know, I stopped short of calling people evil. Mm-hmm. I think all of us have some evil streaks to us probably, or we're not as good a person as we sometimes would like to be. But these people allow evil to exist and to affect people's lives in ways that, in my view, truly is evil. A lot of these practices are entirely they're developed to deceive people, to mislead people. I say in the first part of my book that 45,000 people die in this country every year because they don't have health insurance, and that's true. It is based on research done by Harvard researchers, and I apologize for the role that I played in that incredible statistic that in the United States of America, people are dying many every day because they lack health insurance health coverage. These tactics are intended to help these companies make money. And the way that our system is structured, that is the allegiance that the executives have. And they will use these tactics that I write about in the book. And to your point earlier, I wrote this so that people who are advocating for change that we need, can see how the enemy operates. Mm-hmm. And it's important for you to know your enemy. And that's exactly what this book does. It pulls the curtains back so that you can see what these companies do to win, to influence public opinion. And those of us who are advocating for positive change need to know that. I'm not suggesting that we resort to the same evil tactics, but you can use some of the same things, some of the same techniques that they use in more ethical ways. But you have to play by their games. They set the rules of the game.
Mm. What about the ways in which the sort of spin industry works inside the insurance companies to try to justify rate increases, right? I mean, right now we have people who are either completely not insured or they're insured with really poor coverage, what you call underinsured. And then even those who do have decent insurance every year the insurance rates keep getting hiked up. And the justification that they always give is the increases in medical costs, or they say that Medicare doesn't pay doctors enough, and so doctors charge insurance companies more to make up for it. How do they spin these?
Well, it's called a technique called reframing the debate. They want us to think that they're blameless here, that they have no role to play in increasing premiums, that they're just charging what they have to because they're charged a certain amount by doctors and hospitals. That's nonsense. Health insurance premiums have been increasing much faster than inflation, and even faster than medical inflation. They're doing that because Wall Street expects them to make a certain amount of money, and they have to increase their premiums enough to meet Wall Street's expectations. But they will try to make us think that it is because they're being charged too much by doctors and hospitals, and that these hospitals and doctors are greedy, and that consequently we are having to pay more premiums as a consequence.
I want to quote from your book. You say the size of premium increases has had no relationship to real health costs or anything else except internal greed.
It's true.
Often they, you know, in the healthcare reform debate, there was the statistic, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, about only one penny out of every dollar actually going to profits of these insurance companies, private insurance companies. Is that true? False?
Yeah, and this is an example of one of the techniques that they use. It's a very sophisticated PR technique of using statistics to lie for you, to make a point. Even if that is true, 1% is a huge amount of money in our healthcare system. It's an enormous amount of money that could be used to bring more people into coverage. We have 7 very large for-profit health insurance companies in this country that dominate the market. 1 out of every 3 of us covered by some kind of benefit plan, including Medicare and Medicaid, is offered by one of these 7 companies that I say comprise a cartel. They take in billions and billions of dollars in premium revenue from us every year. And a lot of that is converted into profits for Wall Street and investors, and that pay these executives enormous salaries. So they want us to forget that. They don't want us to see that. They want to give us this kind of statistic that only 1% goes into profit. That's not true, first of all. But even if it were, it's an enormous amount of money.
You talk in your book about using a particular text called How to Use Statistics to Lie.
Right. Yeah, it was a book that ordered a copy of it recently. It's one of the books that I had used when I was in college. It's actually called Lying with Statistics.
Lying with Statistics.
And, you know, the book was not to tell us how to do it, but you can learn how to do it by reading it. But the point was, you need to be aware of, and that's one of the reasons I mentioned it and wrote about it in this book, is so people can be aware that these companies do just that. It's the selective disclosure of certain data and excluding certain other data that would not prove your point. But you look for data and you slice and dice data in certain ways to make the point you want to make and to try to make people believe a certain thing.
I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. One of the statistics that came out during the healthcare reform debate that you also cite in your book is how the majority of personal bankruptcies today are because of medical costs, people going into bankruptcy because they've had an illness, even if they were insured, that they ended up going so deep into debt for that they had to declare personal bankruptcy. The insurance companies try to cut down on the percentage that they pay out for covering procedures, and they use the term loss to describe it, because in their corporate mindset, paying out for medical procedures, which is what they're supposed to do, is actually a loss in revenue. Tell us about this term, the medical loss ratio, that they use to measure a profitability of an insurance company.
Yes, and this is something that Wall Street investors look at even more than any other measure of the corporation. They obviously look at how much the companies make in profit, how much the earnings per share is. But an even important measure for analysts and investors is how much the company is actually paying out in claims. And investors want these companies to pay less and less and less. And so there is constant pressure on these company executives to spend less of our premium dollars on medical care. In 1993, the average amount spent on health care was about 95%. In other words, about 95 cents of every dollar that we paid in a premium was used to pay claims or medical care. Now it's down to at least 80, and in many cases much, much lower than that, which is why Congress, when it passes legislation, has a provision that requires companies to spend at least 80%, which again is far lower than what it was just a few years ago, but at least it sets a floor that they can't go below. But obviously right now, as you can expect, they're trying to influence how that's being implemented and trying to get waivers so that they don't have to comply with it.
My guest is Wendell Potter, a former Cigna PR executive and author of Deadly Spin. You can watch a video of my entire interview with Wendell Potter on uprisingradio.org and share it with your family and friends. After the short break, we'll return with part two of my interview.
Hi, I'm Michael Slate, and I want to invite you to celebrate the grand opening of Revolution Books, Libros Revolucion, in its new location in Hollywood by attending a special screening of the award-winning film Alambrista, a movie about the American nightmare for immigrants. The screening takes place on Sunday, January 9th at 2 p.m. at Barnsdall Art Parks Theater, 4800 Hollywood Boulevard, near Vermont. After the screening, I will be joining renowned director Robert M. Young in conversation about this very timely film and his impressive body of work, including The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, Nothing But a Man, American Me, and Extremities. So again, join me in celebrating the grand opening of Revolution Books, Libros Revolucion, at this very special event. For ticket information, call 323-463-3500. See you January 9th.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We now turn back to Wendell Potter to discuss his book, Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. So one of the things that you go through in your book, among the many, many aspects of healthcare, is the history of the healthcare, American healthcare system in the United States. Can you explain how is it that the U.S. has Medicare, we have Social Security, but we don't have single-payer healthcare, which is almost taken for granted in countries around the world, especially developed countries?
Right. And it took quite a significant effort to get Social Security and Medicare enacted in this country. We have more of a fear because corporations have instilled this fear in us of so-called socialism. So that's one thing. The people who are in control of our healthcare system make a lot of money off of the status quo, and they don't want it to change radically because if they do, they're going to lose profits and they'll lose some income. So they want to scare us into thinking that any significant change will result in us going socialistic or having a government take over the healthcare system. So it's a big part of their disinformation and their lying campaign to make us think that. So that is part of the problem. They have been able to define single payer in a certain way that scares a lot of people.
Going back to what I referred to earlier in our interview about the PR of the insurance industry, can you tell us about one of the earliest campaigns against single-payer healthcare and, you know, referring to it as the beginning of socialism when Ronald Reagan featured in this video that apparently was commissioned by the American Medical Association?
It's true. The American Medical Association has been the organization that has, over the course of many, many decades, been able to block meaningful reform. Keep in mind, we're talking again about when you're talking about reform, it probably will affect someone's income. And the AMA was first and foremost protective of doctors' incomes, and they didn't want anything to change radically that might have an adverse effect on the doctor's ability to earn a certain amount of money. And, of course, they're among the highest paid people in our society. So they, we call it organized medicine, has been able to blunt reform. In the 1960s, they were particularly fearful of Medicare and Medicaid. So they embarked on a campaign to scare people by calling this socialism, and they hired Ronald Reagan to be their pitch man. And he actually cut a CD, actually an LP at that point, and they sent it to doctors' wives around the country and encouraged them to have coffee clutches in which they would invite their friends to come over and play Ronald Reagan's fear-mongering campaign album, and to which he would say that if we enacted Medicare, we would be
turning – we would be having socialized medicine in this country.
And that the America that we know wouldn't exist in a few years.
Oh,
I mean,
exactly.
It was just incredible.
Completely over the top.
Now, this video, it wasn't known that it was the American Medical Association right away that commissioned it. So they did it in secret.
They did. And that's part of the whole thing that I write about here. And it's not just the AMA that's done this. It continues today. These special interests want to make sure you do not know that they're behind it. They go to extra care to hide their association with these campaigns. Most recently, we were the campaign against sicko, for example. Mm-hmm. The insurance industry worked through a big PR firm. They funnel a lot of our premium dollars into this PR firm to set up a front group called Healthcare America to do a lot of the disinformation about the movie and about Michael Moore. No one ever knew that the insurance industry was involved in any way.
They use these very innocuous sounding names. Going back to the AMA, what has the relationship between organized medicine and insurance companies been over the years? Today doctors are realizing more and more that insurance companies are not necessarily their friends. More and more people, more and more doctors are realizing that it's in their patients' interest and their own interest to have a government system of healthcare.
Right. More and more doctors are. And the AMA is finally coming around to catch on to the fact that it's not a good thing to live under a healthcare system controlled by corporate insurance companies. They are not being treated the way that they thought that they would be treated in a so-called free market environment. And so a lot of doctors are coming around to understand the importance of a greater role for government. So we're seeing a shift there. In the past, the insurance companies and the doctors of the AMA have been allied. They were during the Clinton years to help kill the Clinton plan. They both hated certain parts of the Clinton plan, so they became allies. That wasn't the case during this most recent debate, and the AMA finally came on board to support the legislation.
I want to turn back to how insurance companies have essentially rewritten the landscape of healthcare in this country. You have a whole chapter in your book dedicated to what's called consumer-driven insurance, which, most ordinary people don't really understand what that means. In it, you describe the move away from HMOs towards what's called consumer-driven insurance. What exactly is consumer-driven insurance?
Right. Consumer-driven insurance is, the term is a euphemism. Mm-hmm. It's not anything that consumers have been clamoring for, but the insurance industry decided to put the word consumer in the name to make people think that it was something that was consumer-friendly, and maybe even consumers were actually creating these kinds of plans or behind the creation of them. They are a euphemism for high-deductible plans and also limited-benefit plans, but primarily these are plans in which you enroll and you pay your premiums, but you pay a lot more out of your own pocket for care if you get sick or injured through these high-deductibles. And sometimes they can be relatively modest. The deductibles might be $1,000 or $2,000, but increasingly they're getting to be huge deductibles. There's a health plan, a for-profit plan in Maine, Anthem of Maine, that has been marketing a plan that has a $30,000 annual deductible, which means you can be paying your premiums every month thinking that you have decent coverage, but if you get sick, you're not going to get any coverage at all until you pay $30,000 out of your own pocket.
And these are being marketed to people who don't necessarily make much more than $30,000 a year?
Well, that's exactly it. Most of the people who are buying these don't make that much money, so they would have to pay more than they make in a given year to actually get coverage. So these companies, these insurance companies, are benefiting. They're taking people's premiums, and people are buying something they think that is of value. But in many cases, they would actually be better off without coverage. They are enriching these insurance companies. But if they get really sick, the insurance company is not going to be there for them.
So essentially, they sold this idea as one where consumers would be able to have more control over their own health insurance and choose to pay certain kinds of premiums for certain kinds of policies and then be more prudent about what kind of health care they got. I mean, this was amazing. It implied, it made the assumption that people were you know, getting more health care than they needed. I mean, who wants to go to the doctor unless they have to, even if you're completely covered?
Oh, it's true. And they were trying to make us think that we are overusing health care. But you're right. I know very few people who go to the doctor on a regular basis just because they want to. It's just not something that we do. In fact, it's usually the opposite that's true. People wait too long to go to the doctor. And that certainly is something that's happening now, even more than ever before, with people in these high deductible plans. They're foregoing care that they need because they know they have to pay so much out of their own pocket that they can't afford. So, yeah, that we're spending money in paying premiums, but we will avoid going to the doctor or going to the hospital when we need to. That makes us and people are not picking up their medications that are prescribed by the doctors. And the consequences are often grave for people who do that.
And how, going back earlier, though, how did the HMOs, you know, essentially, how did the move away from HMOs happen? HMOs were essentially initially a way for people to have lower healthcare costs, and you describe that history in your book. But then, as they got bought up by these big insurance companies, they got a really bad rep because they just started abusing consumers and patients, I should say.
Yeah, HMO and the concept of managed care, it's really kind of a Western and Southwestern, something that happened in this part of the country. Mm-hmm. But and it worked for many people for many, many years. The people have been very happy to have been enrolled in a Kaiser plan in the early years, and obviously many still are today.
So that was where people just went to a network of doctors.
They did, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the care was what we call integrated, or what is called integrated. The Kaiser model, for example, owns its own hospitals and employs its own doctors and nurses. So it has a very large staff, and they're called staff model HMOs, or they used to be that. And they provided very good care, and people were very happy with the care that they got, and often the care was high quality because it was coordinated.
And it was low cost they were within a certain network.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They were exactly right. The insurance companies started looking at this model, and in fact, it happened during the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration heard about the Kaiser model and decided, well, this might be a way for us to salvage or to keep the free enterprise system alive in the healthcare system. Ted Kennedy at that point was really making a lot of progress to persuade Americans to go to a Medicare for all type of a healthcare system. So Richard Nixon said, well, maybe we can shift people into HMOs. And then the big insurance companies started saying this is a way to make a lot of money by moving people into very restricted networks. So they took a good idea and they made the restrictions so onerous and the restrictions on doctors in particular so onerous that there was a huge backlash against the HMOs.
And then they sold people the consumer, so-called consumer-driven plans.
That's exactly right. People get so upset with their HMOs that the insurance industry had to start relaxing some of their restrictions to the point that they were not able to control costs there. So now their new silver bullet is to move people into these so-called consumer-driven plans.
Wendell Potter, we hear a lot about consolidation in certain industries, media consolidation, for example. How are media controlled by only a few handful of companies? And I want to talk about the role of the media in a moment. But the insurance company consolidation is another aspect in your book that you discuss. How and just referring to what we just mentioned, how big insurance companies are eating up smaller and smaller companies because the system today just doesn't tolerate competition. Are we seeing a future, if this just goes unchallenged, where we might just have a very small handful, two or three big insurance companies that are just taking our money, and now with a government mandate, if it stands, we'll get our money handed to them on a platter?
Well, it's a trend that has been going on for some time, and it would continue with or without health care reform. The reform legislation, if it's implemented as is intended, it will get rid of some of the what I call the bad actors, and there are plenty of those who are in business to do nothing except sell largely junk insurance. But we are seeing this trend. We've seen an enormous amount of consolidation in the industry. The other trend that's been going on is the conversion of nonprofit health plans to mm-hmm. for-profit status. A lot of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans in the country, all of them used to be operating on a nonprofit basis. Now, many, many of them, including here in California mm-hmm. and other big states, have converted to for-profit status, and most of them now are part of a large corporation called WellPoint. They may be called Anthem of California, Anthem Blue Cross of California, but they're owned by this huge behemoth of a corporation called WellPoint that's based in Indianapolis now. And they've been gobbling up smaller plans, and the other companies, the other big insurance companies have been doing the same thing, so that we now have a cartel of big insurance companies in this country.
So one of the other aspects of the way in which health insurance companies worsen the quality of health care is what they call these benefit buy-downs, mm-hmm. Which you also call a euphemism. Is this also part of their consumer-driven policy approach?
It's their approach of shifting more of the cost to us. It absolutely is. And it is a euphemism that few people have heard about except in the health insurance industry and Wall Street analysts and investors. When you are listening to a call, and I would encourage listeners and viewers if your insurance company is announcing quarterly earnings, call in and see what's being discussed. And you'll hear often this conversation about the benefit buy-downs. What that means is the insurance company is reducing your benefits or making you pay more out of your own pocket for those benefits if you can still get them. And they call that a buy-down. That's a euphemism for screwing you.
My guest is Wendell Potter. He's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. He used to work for Cigna, very high position doing PR, public relations for Cigna. He's currently a senior fellow in healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. Let's talk about the role of the media. And it's, I think, a great thing that you are working at the Center for Media and Democracy so that you can share your inside information with this organization that's working for justice and issues like healthcare. The media, in order for the insurance companies to get away with selling lies during the healthcare reform debate and justify their rate increases using, you know, faulty statistics, is by having a compliant media that doesn't question them. What role, you know, how guilty is the mainstream media in the mess that we're in today on healthcare?
Very guilty. What's left of the mainstream media, and that's a point that I make in the book as well. We've seen a rapid decline of mainstream media. We have fewer newspapers than we've ever had before, and newsrooms have been shrinking. So many reporters have lost their jobs. We have far fewer reporters who are professional journalists working today than when I was a journalist in my first career. I was a newspaper reporter ultimately in Washington. And I've seen a huge change in the way the media operates and the number of reporters. And a lot of our media, mainstream media, is, you know, it's owned by corporations. And so things have changed radically. And the few reporters that are left are even busier than ever before. They have very little time to devote to any individual story. As a consequence, investigative reporting has almost bit the dust. And I write in the book about how I could just often have my way with reporters because of this dynamic. I would often just, to avoid actually being on the phone or having a conversation with a reporter, when they would call, I would develop a statement that I would make sure that the lawyers and the executives were happy with, and I would email it back to the reporter. And more often than not, they would accept that, and that would be the end of the interaction. Mm-hmm. And they would take that, and they would say, this is, you know, what Cigna had to say or Humana had to say. You see it all the time. They're just carefully crafted statements, and you essentially, if you're a PR person, say, this is it. Take it or leave it. And usually they will take it, and that's the end of it.
And then at times during the healthcare reform debate, sometimes all it took was one prominently placed op-ed in the Wall Street Journal casting a story in a certain light that could change a debate and cause almost a cascade effect. Fox News has had success creating misinformation that then cascades into the rest of the media. Right. And one successful talking point, whether it's true or not, can derail an entire legislative process.
Oh, it absolutely does. And much thought is given to crafting these talking points and these phrases that have the intended effect of derailing reform or shaping it or scaring people into believing something that isn't true so that the special interests can win the day in terms of reform. That goes on all the time. And it's very, very devious. And that's why I wrote the book, was to make people see how this goes on. And our opinions are manipulated every day in ways that we have no idea how it goes on. And I wanted people to be aware of this. Mm-hmm. We get to the point of opposing something that is in our best interest and voting against candidates, voting against our own best interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, you used the word devious. So I want to turn to the president of America's health insurance plans, Karen Ignani, who is a woman who is an amazing character, who I don't think most of us would even know her name or know much about her unless we're really closely following the healthcare debate or reading your book. And she used to work for labor union, but is now the insurance industry's most powerful advocate. Tell us a little bit about her and the role that she played in killing real reform.
She is incredibly sophisticated, one of the smartest lobbyists, most articulate lobbyists that I've ever seen. So she is actually a godsend for the health insurance industry. She's attractive.
And you've worked with her.
And I've worked with her. Mm-hmm. I know her. And she is perceived to be very sincere. And she does. You're right. She has a background having worked in labor. So she came to the industry back about the same time I joined Cigna in the early 90s from labor. She's well-connected on Capitol Hill. She's perceived to be someone who's a straight shooter. She's just darn good. I've never seen anything quite like it. She can captivate audiences. She can make sure that people see her as a credible source. And I don't want to discredit her unduly, but I just want to make sure that people understand just how effective she is in getting what she wants for the industry on Capitol Hill. She's also very good with the news media. She's someone that the media goes to often to get the industry's point of view. She is just absolutely perfect for the health insurance industry.
And so she played this role where with President Obama during the healthcare reform debate, the last one, she was able to convince him and his cabinet that she was an honest broker representing insurance companies that were now finally for the first time going to actually work with the White House and Congress to pass real reform because they too realized the system was broken. But
right.
Meanwhile, she was orchestrating this very dirty campaign to discredit
right.
the whole battle.
That's exactly right.
And did Obama get it? Did he see that he was being played?
I don't think he did. At least it wasn't evident to me. And in fact, that is exactly why I decided to start speaking out. I could see that he was being played, as I said, like a Stradivarius. And he truly was. He was being rolled by the insurance industry. He felt, I'm certain, and he has a lot of confidence in his own abilities to bring people together of diverse opinions and have people work together for a common good. But I think he completely underestimated the power and influence and the behavior of the insurance industry. They had no intention ever of playing honorably. They were, from the very beginning, saying one thing and doing just the other behind the scenes.
And the group that you represent, America's Health Insurance Plans, these are basically a collection of the CEOs of the top insurance companies.
They are. They are. And the organization has been controlled considerably by the big for-profit insurance companies. Now, interestingly, because the legislation that was enacted didn't suit all the CEOs perfectly, there are still some consumer protections in this legislation and some things that will help consumers. They didn't like that. So now they are talking about forming their own little entity, the big for-profit insurance companies, so that they can focus their dollars and resources even in a more focused way to get what they want on Capitol Hill.
Wendell, the last chapter in your book is called The Playbook, on how to influence lawmakers and regulators through the manipulation of public opinion. You say this is a very carefully guarded playbook. Does this really exist, or is it just a sort of an agreed-upon set of ideas or standard formula that the industry uses to protect their interests?
It's been developed over the years, it really goes back to efforts to persuade people that smoking cigarettes was no big deal, that we shouldn't worry, we should not even believe the Surgeon General who was saying that, you know, it was a hazard to our health. And that's been going on for many years. The tobacco industry knew that it had to mount a very sophisticated PR campaign to mislead people so that they would continue to kill themselves by smoking their products. And so this playbook was essentially developed to make people believe what was not true, and they were smoking and leading to their deaths prematurely. The same tactics are used by the insurance industry, by not only big tobacco, but big food, the food and beverage industry, coal and gas industries, you name it. Any industry that is trying to pull the wool over our eyes, make us see things that in ways that they want us to see, to manipulate our public opinion, usually to influence public policy, they use this playbook.
Right. So is this something that you were schooled in when you first became the PR guy at Cigna?
You know, it's interesting you use the word school. When I was in PR school many years ago, I never heard of a front group. I never heard of any of these tactics. And
they don't teach you that.
They don't teach you that. That's something that you learn when you're a senior executive in a PR firm. You learn what's going on, or you become, a junior person who's doing a lot of the work. You don't really, if you're junior, have a big role in creating the campaigns, but you're expected to play a role in implementing them. These really are dirty tricks. They are devious tactics that you would never hear in a classroom at a university. But it's the way a lot of PR is conducted, regrettably.
Finally, Wendell Potter, last two questions. Has your resignation and your speaking out inspired any of your former colleagues, either in Cigna or other insurance companies? And do you have any idea how your former colleagues actually view you and the work you're doing now?
You know, it has inspired people. I've heard from many people, including some who still work in the industry, who've called me or sent me emails quietly to let me know that they're proud of what I'm doing, they're supportive of what I'm doing. And there have been many people who have left the industry in recent years who've contacted me. They are afraid, though, they're afraid of consequences. And people are talking about fear. People are afraid of making significant change. They're afraid of retaliation. I was, too. I wish more people would consider doing what I'm doing, but there is just too much fear of being having your character assassinated, being attacked like Michael Moore was attacked as a filmmaker.
Did you get attacked?
I didn't. You know, I think it's interesting. They have tried to use some right-wing organizations to attack me by challenging my credibility, but they've been limited because they know I really was on the inside for all these years.
There's plenty of documentation.
Plenty of documentation, and I was a spokesman for these folks.
With your name right there.
With my name on it, and reporters know me, and they know that I tell the truth. So they've had a difficult time discrediting me.
Just in terms of the fear that you were talking about earlier, after doing what you did, do you feel liberated?
Absolutely. It's the most important thing I've ever done and the best thing I've ever done. I was having trouble sleeping, and I was, honest to God, at the point of looking at myself in the mirror and saying, who are you and how did you get here? How did this happen to
you? You talked in your book about your struggles with alcoholism.
I did. Whether I was an alcoholic, I don't know, but I certainly was using alcohol to numb myself so that I really wouldn't think about what I was actually doing, both the unethical PR practices and being a spokesman for an industry that was engaging in practices that were really killing people.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wendell Potter, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonali. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Wendell Potter is a former Cigna executive and author of Deadly Spin. And that does it for the program. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Eric Fromm once said, greed is a bottomless pit which exhausts the person in an endless effort to satisfy the need without ever reaching satisfaction. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8. I tiptoe on a slip rope bound to